The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Back to the regularly scheduled program. Second quarter comes to a close with a whimper. GE booted from the Dow Jones Industrials and rallies. Listener questions and our guest, Raghi Horner from Simpler Trading. All this and much more on episode number 569 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello there and welcome to July 2018. This is the beginning of July, first day, and we are here back. This is Andrew Horowitz. And I'm your host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast and co-host of DH Unplugged, which you can hear each and every Tuesday at 9 p.m. or download from your favorite podcast directory, iTunes, wherever it may be. Before we start, I want to give a quick shout out to my good friend Bill. Happy birthday. Just got back from his birthday bash. It was a white party. We dress up all in white. And it was a barbecue. I'm thinking to myself, oh my, between red wine, barbecue sauce, I got all this white stuff on. How's that going to work out? Well, good news. Not a drop was spilled. Everybody was there in white. It was pretty cool. Lots of fun. Lots of good people. Lots of good friends. So happy birthday, Bill. And yeah, we're back. It's been a while. We haven't really been away. No, we haven't been away. But what we were was involved with that FinTech special, those special episodes where we had all of the great FinTech leaders from New York when I was at the Benzinga FinTech Awards. And hopefully you got a lot out of that. I thought there was a great amount of information, just an incredible amount of detail about what's going on in the area of fintech and how it affects us, what's going to be out there in the future, and what to look forward to. So hopefully you got something out of that. But we're going to be back now talking about the things we always talk about: finance, investments, education, understanding markets, giving you hopefully a leg up in the area of your portfolio. And we have good things to talk about today. I want to start off with talking a little bit about some of the things that are happening right now. We've seen that oil has rallied dramatically, the highest price, I believe it's since 2014, as the OPEC leaders decided that, yeah, they're going to increase production, but not at the level that was expected or hoped for by most. And that sent oil rallying over the last few weeks. And you're going to probably see that starting to put up some of the numbers over on the board in the gas station soon, and it's going to be a little bit more expensive during the summer driving months to fill up your car, your boat, your RV, whatever it may be. But it's probably going to cost a little bit more. Now, of course, once that happened and we didn't see that OPEC seemed to cooperate in the way that everybody was expecting them to or hoping that they would, and oil continued to rally, President Trump stepped in. And over the weekend, as a matter of fact, he had said that he wants to see that OPEC is going to do something because he believes, I believe he said this in an interview, that OPEC is manipulating the oil market. And he wanted them to, in particular, he wanted Saudi Arabia to increase production by about 2 million barrels. And the question is, do they have that capability? I mean, I don't know. There was some back and forth about how, yeah, they agreed, but they're not. And there's a, you know, 2 million barrels per day, hoping that they can increase it just by Saudi Arabia. And at the same time, we're going to put sanctions on countries and companies that work with Iran. And we're going to have a full shutdown of any purchase of oil from Iran, from us, and pushing it on the allies into, I believe it's last quarter of the year where the stop is going to be. I think it's November. So Saudi Arabia says, well, maybe we can do so. We're not sure if we can, and possibly we could do. We have the spare capacity. And then there was some backtracking from this tweet that there was some agreement. There really wasn't an agreement. There was the hope for. So we're not quite sure what's going to happen. But if, in fact, we do see that we are constantly seeing a incredible amount of drawdown of inventory. Last week's inventory was a 9 million barrel oil inventory drawdown of barrels. And that's pretty significant. And if we see that going into the summer with everybody pumping at the levels that they're pumping, both here in the U.S. and overseas, then we're going to see higher oil prices. We're going to talk to our guest about that a little bit more because I have some questions with regard to that whole area of oil and how it affects retail. And I think she's the person to ask about that. So stick around and let's talk a little bit more about that. We also have the final few days of the quarter were once again a little bit wonky. We have the specter of tariffs and the potential for additional tariffs going to be placed on China. China retaliating, the Chinese currency dropping very significantly in a, well, what it looks like, another measure to combat and to offset some of the tariffs that are going to be put upon China from the U.S. And that means that that's a big problem. So we already saw that Harley-Davidson could be shifting production overseas because they believe they're going to be taking a significant amount of losses from the tariffs of bikes they manufacture here, ship over to Europe. Therefore, what they said is, hey, the hell with this. We're going to move the production over to Europe and not have the tariffs. Well, that pissed off the White House, saying that, hey, if they do that, they're going to be taking a big hit. They shouldn't be doing this. Now, I don't think that the White House has the capability to target one company, but they're forcing their hand. This is the unexpected consequences of imposing tariffs without doing your homework, without understanding what the ramifications would be. And this is the things that we've been talking about week in and week out, month in and month out, about this whole tariff shenanigans. The problem is you don't know when you push on one part of the economy what bulges on the other side. It's the butterfly effect in economic terms. The butterfly effect where a butterfly flaps its wings over in Asia somewhere and it ends up to be a hurricane here in Florida. When you have tariffs being pressed on countries without, again, a significant amount of understanding of how this all fits together, what ends up happening is Harley-Davidson moves to their facility, fires a bunch of employees here in the United States, and moves to Europe for a piece of their production. So this whole tariff thing is getting out of hand. In fact, in further discussion, when we went from, I think it was $50 billion against China to $100 billion, $150 billion against China, then it went to $200 billion. Now they're talking about upwards of $500 billion of tariff if China doesn't make a deal. I mean, this is a deal at gunpoint is what it is. It's kind of like Chicagoland style economic and globalization. You're going to do it our way, or we're going to pretty much pound you into the sand. Now, I agree, and everybody agrees. Listen, everybody agrees that for a long time, China has taken advantage of the United States. No question about that. For a while, it was currency. That kind of backed off, and that got regulated, and it straightened itself out pretty well. Then there are the other tariffs or impositions or sanctions or taxes, whatever you want to call them, that China puts on imports into their country. So that's something we want to, of course, do away with. But you have to realize that there's a playing field that needs to be level across the board. And sometimes that doesn't mean that just everybody gets the exact same thing. It all depends on what the benefit is from one country to another. It's possible that the goods that are coming from China benefit us in a much greater way than they do from another country. And therefore, maybe we're willing to pay up a little bit more for that in some way or another. Maybe we're getting a better deal on product X. And you know what? We'll pay a little bit more for product Y. Or we're getting such a good deal on a particular sector of materials that we're willing to say, okay, if that's the case, then if we sell into your country, we'll pay, you know, your people pay a little bit more on your side. There's a balance. So it's not just a 1 + 1 = 2 situation. You have to look at all this very carefully before you start just throwing out all these numbers and pressing on one thing or another. Because like I said, you bulge something else on the other side that was unintentional. I wanted to move away from this discussion for a second, and let's talk about something I've talked about on DH Unplugged before I get to our guest. I want to talk about just a look back on the beginning of the year and something that I've continually struggled with. Something that we've seen that really, I think, had a very significant impact on my understanding of what the intention and understanding of mutual fund managers, ETF, active ETF managers, and analysts and institutional managers. If you remember, I talked about how in the beginning of the year, we invited a lot of different companies in to pretty much, well, give us a pitch. You know, what's your best idea for the year? We do a lot of business with mutual fund companies and ETFs and outside managers. And well, I said, do me a favor, after they told us all about how they're doing, their fund selection and all the things about what they want to talk about, I said, listen, tell me something. For 2018, this is back in January, 2018, what's your best idea? Give me a couple of them. And it's really interesting because you know what they said pretty much universally? Emerging market equities, pretty much the top number one. Number two, emerging market debt. Number three was non-US equities. They wanted like Europe and Asia. And financials. Emerging market equities, emerging market debt, non-US equities, and financials. And US financials are included in that. Now, I look back on that and I've been studying this for some time and waiting for, well, okay, when's that breakout going to happen? When is this all going to go? Now, remember, back in January, things were looking just peachy. This was right on. In the beginning of January through about the third week of January, everything looked like, oh yeah, these guys are doing pretty good. They come in, they tell us what's going on. And sure enough, look at how great it is. Now we resisted getting heavily invested in any of these areas because, in other words, we didn't overweight any of these areas because I said, you know, there's too many players on one side here and something's not right. While we can consider them the momentum crowd, we can consider them the follow the leader, the penguins, if you will, whereas one goes in the water and they all follow. We could look at it that way. But I said, there's too much coincidence of all this. Everybody talking the same story. No outliers from what we said. And it was a small sample. I'll give you that. It's not like we blanket went after every single analyst out there and institutional advisor out there and every mutual fund. But we had a small grouping, but it was very odd that they all said the same thing. And we watched and waited. And we have some allocation to these areas for our portfolios. But okay, we watched and waited. We didn't overweight. And now what we're finding is these things are in just looking terrible. Why? Well, you have the US dollar that's increasing. That's really hurting emerging markets. We have liquidity crunch because the Fed is taking liquidity out of the markets right now. A lot of things happening with regard to emerging market debt and equities that don't look so healthy. Non-US equities in Europe and Asia, not doing so well either. And financials, up until Friday, things weren't looking so good. As a matter of fact, Thursday was the lowest price of the year for the XLF, the financial ETF, until Friday came when the Fed came out with their discussion about, yeah, everybody could do buybacks and issue higher dividends, and the sector moved up a little bit, about 1.5%. But I found it really interesting. What does this tell us? Well, it tells us that it's not always necessary to follow the leaders. Into, when I say the leaders, I don't mean the leading sectors. I mean the leaders in terms of those out there that are on TV or on the radio or, you know, making prognostications through some kind of newsletter. You know, you have to do your own research here and understand, well, let's take what they say and put it into the entire process and make our own decisions. Because so far, this has been one of probably the worst 6 months for these areas that we've seen in a while. Exactly opposite of what they talked about. So you can't always follow what they're talking about and follow those that are talking their book completely. You got to be really careful about that. That includes podcasts and anybody else that's talking these. Do your own research. Again, if you like a particular analyst, all right, fine. Follow what they're talking about. Make sure what they're talking about makes sense to you. And when you follow through on your research, your analysis, you agree with it. Just don't blindly move into it. Just a point of reference here. All right. Let's see here. Let's get to our guest, I think. And then we are going to come back with two or three questions. I answered a lot of questions directly. If you want to ask me a question, by the way, on any topic on the financial spectrum, simply go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, click on the Ask Andrew button, and ask away. We'll put it on the show coming up, or I'll answer you directly. Since we had the fintech conferences and the podcast that focused on that for such a while, I kind of answered a lot of the questions and emails. So we have a few left over that I thought would be really interesting. But anyway, let's get to our guest and then go from there. And we'll come back. We'll talk about all of these questions that we have lined up. And our guest today is Raghi Horner, and she's a futures and currency expert with Simpler Trading. And if you didn't know this, the name Raghi could mean queen of queens, so the queen of trading. It's also someone who could have a little bit of an edge to the angry side. So, Raghi, hopefully we're going to get you on the queen of trading side of things here today. How are you?
I'm doing very well. That's the best introduction I've ever had. I'm so happy to be here.
Thanks. So I wanted to kind of talk about the whole idea of futures, which for a lot of people in the, you know, the world of investing, especially people who really just trade stocks and ETFs, it's an area I think they're kind of nervous of, and maybe rightfully so, because there is some additional, a lot of additional risk involved. But talk to me a little bit about how you discuss and explain starting off people with the idea of either trading or tracking or learning about futures and currencies.
I think the biggest thing that probably scares people off is once they understand what the leverage means to their position, they realize that everything is accelerated, whether that be the wins or the losses. Because the way that I look at it, and this is the way that I teach and trade myself, is if we're looking at a chart, the symbol in the upper left-hand corner of our chart almost means nothing to me anymore. What I want everyone to remember is we want to focus on liquidity. We want to focus on markets that we have a trade idea around, whether that's Apple or whether that's silver, whether that's the S&P or soybeans. They all have narratives. What makes futures and currency so different is the leverage. I think that it's also interesting that as much as people are comfortable with equities, you know, if you trade the S&P futures, the Dow, the Russell, the NASDAQ, you're playing a basket of stocks. You know, if you were to dissect these popular index futures contracts, they really are just a basket of stocks. So I think there's a lot more in common that, say, a stock trader would have to a futures contract. And then when we get down to the grocery store of the world, that's what futures markets really are. You know, you look at, for example, soybeans, which have been in the news so much lately with the tariffs out of China. There are these huge global implications to these tariffs on soybeans. And yet, here's this very tangible thing that grows in the earth that people tend to get a little intimidated about because they may not understand the cycle of soybeans, whether that be planting and seasonals. But the same cycles apply to stocks. So I think there's more in common than not, but it's that leverage that I think a lot of people, and rightfully so, fear.
Yeah, because if you're trading the SPY ETF on the S&P 500 and you trade and you buy $10,000 worth and it moves up a small amount, it's dollar for dollar, percent per percent. Whereas if you buy $10,000 worth of contracts in the S&P minis, there's a multiplier, like a 5x multiplier or more for depending on which contract and if you're going to go with S&Ps or you're going to go with the Qs or whatever you're doing. But there's a lot more potential. And the big difference is it trades 24/7.
Absolutely. And I think the 24/7 part is what excites me because you make a great point about the accessibility. I think if we're looking at equities right now and we know so much of what's moving the equities markets is happening not between, say, LA and New York, but what's happening in the UK, what's happening in Europe, most definitely what's happening between the US and China. A lot of major moves are happening in these traditional non-active hours, you know, after 4 p.m. and before 8 or 9 a.m. Eastern. And one of the things I like to remind traders of is this is an increasingly 24-hour world we live in, and therefore a lot of these 24-hour names are definitely where I have my attention. I think the risk is easier to control with a market that's open nearly 5.5 days a week with small gaps in the trading.
Yeah.
The word small gaps in terms of, right, you know, when the exchange itself closes for us.
Right. Give everybody a little bit of a rest. Even God rested one day, right? Or two, depending on how you look at it. But so let's talk about a couple of different things. So I know you focus in on oil, and you were focusing on oil for some time. But let's talk about this whole idea of rising oil prices and this whole, you know, the gasoline supplies are coming in. And now all of a sudden, here we are. And I feel like I've said this 100 times over the last number of years. Here we are coming into the summer and oil prices are raging higher. And we haven't seen as much, at least down here in Florida, we haven't seen as much of a of an adjustment in terms of the price of the gas at the pump so much. You know, I've heard in other areas it's been a lot more dramatic. But we've seen since a year ago in July where crude oil was trading at about $52 or so. We're talking about almost a 50% increase in the base price of WTI oil. And there's a lot of factors from that, right? But how is that going to affect consumers? What's going to happen here?
Well, I think consumers are already feeling the pressure at the pump, where we've seen the rally in crude take unleaded gas with it, take heating oil with it. And I think ultimately what we're finding is, again, kind of going back to our early conversation, just how global geopolitics and geoeconomics is, where we have Iranian sanctions affecting the price of crude. We have the China tariffs between the U.S. affecting the price of crude. So not that everything is going to come down to the macro and the fundamentals, but for any trader out there, you know, they have to understand what's happening on the charts. They have to understand the technicals and the price. But then there are going to be these larger psychological, you know, stories that hang over, like these massive narratives that can move the market. So the one that's moving crude right now for sure is really twofold. One, of course, as you mentioned, big move in crude, now sitting at, what, $73, $74 a barrel. You know, why are we up here? Even though OPEC has mentioned they're going to increase production, it's because they're not going to be able to increase production at the rate needed to offset the sanctions in Iran, taking maybe a million to a million and a half barrels offline from the global marketplace. China, India, South Korea, these are countries that are going to be affected by that. And they're massive oil consumers, you know, purchasers. And then I think, you know, move down the line to where the consumer's feeling it with what's happening with gas. We're seeing right now refiners are making tremendous strides in the fact that, one, we have this WTI product coming from the U.S. So they're not importing it. It's right here in the U.S. And two, the spread between WTI and Brent is the widest it's been in probably about 4 years. And so now they're actually able to buy their light sweet crude at a discount. And so I kind of liken it to, if you're selling lemonade, lemonade's selling at a premium, but lemons are pretty cheap by comparison globally. And the refiners are doing really well. So I think a lot of traders might want to look down the line and say, hey, what are some of the stocks and some of the ETFs that are benefiting from these moves happening in commodities?
You know, it's interesting because it's the equation is almost identical with a slight twist for banks, where banks will benefit if they can lend money at a higher rate and get money in at a lower rate, right? So they lend money out at a high rate and they're only, you know, paying out small amounts on deposits. But what's happened lately is that yield spread, which is very similar to what you're talking about, the crack spread, if you will, I guess the oil and the WTI and the and the Brent spreads,
mm-hmm.
You know, what happens here is that, you know, that margin increase, that structure of the actual two that create the underlying benefit and profitability for this refiners is really good. Whereas banks at this point, we see interest rates, the 2-10 is the lowest it's been, the tightest it's been since 2007. And there's a lot of things that are going on, by the way, that I find fascinatingly similar. Now, let me just, before anybody freaks out, I'm not saying there's going to be a crash. There's a whole different dynamic going on right now. There's a whole different structure with the banks and all. But there's a lot of little things that are starting to line up that are very similar to the mid-2000s. Do you see that as well?
I absolutely agree. I think it's kind of back and forth, right? On one hand, the charts and the feeling I think we're getting, especially the last, say, 6 days since this market's pulled back more dramatically with the tariffs, you know, ratcheting up with the CFIUS, you know,
hoo-ha.
Being hoo-ha. Thrown around as a way to prevent. Oh, yeah, CFIUS. We're getting two alphabet soup here. So basically, a lot of folks know that the U.S. is trying to prevent China from investing too much in tech companies.
Right.
We've already seen this play out in Broadcom, Qualcomm, right? So that the U.S. has said, look, it's in the interest of national security to keep foreign countries, including China, most especially China, from investing in U.S. companies.
Right.
And so we've seen that for sure impact the tech sector and the market as this just ratchets up the fear about the implications and just how much longer this tariff volleyball match is going to go back and forth. But one thing I will tell investors, and I think this has a lot to do with midterm elections, that the hyperbole to which a lot of these tariffs have been elevated to, I'm going to throw 25% tariffs at you. No, I'm going to throw, that type of back and forth, quid pro quo. It's got to really start to end because we do have the elections in November. And China has hit the middle of the country, the Rust Belt, very hard with their tariffs on things like soybeans. It's affected Caterpillar. It's affected Deere. It's even affected stocks like Boeing.
You know the difference between the tariff discussion and the elections between the U.S. and China? The difference is that there are no elections anymore in China. President Xi is now lifetime. So he can play volleyball all he wants, and it doesn't matter. He'll keep his job. Whereas here, there could be a major turnaround and upset for a variety of politicians that maybe are seeing that the current actions of our government are hurting them in the pocketbook. And that's kind of what we, by the way, that's the other thing. We've structured this whole, talk about another narrative. The whole narrative is politics equals, okay, get the guy in that I can benefit from the most financially versus any morality issues or, I'm kind of going a little off the rails here, but morality issues or social change, or it's all about money. And therefore, if that's the platform that everybody's living on, and they're playing to, the fact that there are such pains, as you mentioned, in the pricing of underlying whether it's machinery or commodities or manufacturing products and all that, that's going to hurt them, and that's going to be a big problem during the midterms, or could be at least.
I totally agree, and that's why I think there's a sort of a tick-tock, the clock's ticking, to where the U.S. has to ease up on the way in which we've been ratcheting up the tariff. Not so much with the EU, but certainly with China. China, though, has their own issues. I mean, if you want to hit the Chinese hard, you hit the richest Chinese in that economy. And you look at where the Hang Seng is sitting. I mean, it's now in bearish territory. You look at the Dow, you look at the Hang Seng, you look at the Nikkei, which oftentimes becomes a proxy for that region. And you're seeing that stock market is down and down sharply. I am very optimistic that both these economies are going to say, look, we can keep going back and forth at one another, but at some point we are going to start to just lose. Both these countries are going to lose. And I think with both the equities markets down the way they are, it's not like it's hurting the U.S. and not China, or China and not the U.S. It's to everyone's interest that we get to the table. I just think it's going to be the U.S. that's going to have to instigate it.
That's where your problem lies, because I think some of the current administration is a little bit, let's just say they're stubborn. And we'll have to see if they actually, the other day when they came out with we're not going to do everybody, we're going to just do, according to this, or no, it's not going to be technology companies across the world. You misunderstood that. I mean, you did see a little bit of backwalking on some of this stuff, of walking back. But let's kind of go on to another topic here, because we can go around in circles on this, and I have, by the way.
Sure.
So just to China for a second. So, about, I think it was 2 or 3 months ago, if I'm not mistaken, China started trading their own crude futures, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that does it have anything to do with the price of oil as it recently went up so dramatically? Or is this just really the combination of tariffs, the supply issues and demand?
Well, when we think about why crude's up the way it is, let me just step back to something even technical for a moment. Crude never really turned into a downtrend for all intents and purposes. The support that we saw at 64, the timing in front of the OPEC meeting really did lend itself well to traders like myself who decided this is really just technically an oversold level that we could look for an opportunity long in. I think we also look at the backdrop of in whose best interest is it to see crude at either 52 versus 72.
Oh, yeah.
And that comes right back to the Saudis.
Yeah.
I mean, the Saudis want to get that Aramco IPO, and that seems to be sometimes lost in the shuffle. They had their last go-round about a year ago. It fell on deaf ears. It was just crickets because the price of crude wasn't at 72. It was closer to 52 this time around, and they need the money. You know, their government needs that Aramco IPO to go off well. They're going to start that roadshow up again late this year, early next. And I'm going to bet dollars to donuts that we're going to be closer to 92 when that happens.
Yeah.
Because they need it to be there.
I've always said this. I've always said that the whole reason why oil is going up, aside from the potential for some of the disruptions that we may be seeing in Libya or maybe some of the Iranian news we hear here and there, is the fact that, and we're pumping more, by the way, we're pumping more oil in the United States than ever before. So why is oil going up? Well, I think it's very simple. It's a matter of the higher that the Saudis can push the price of oil, the more they'll get that, for the IPO, and the more benefit that it will do for them. So they're willing to constrain some of their shorter term by, of course, initiating production cuts to make sure this IPO goes off pretty well and just, bankroll on the back end.
And I think you bring up a good point about the shale, because one of the things that I'm noticing and one of the places that I've been focusing on the related stock play when it comes to what's happening in crude oil is we are absolutely looking at very productive, finally profitable wells. But the completed but basically discontinued wells, they call them DUCs. I forgot what the acronym is exactly. But basically, we have these wells that we're not using any longer. We're going to basically cap these because we can't get the shale oil to market. We don't have the infrastructure. The pipeline infrastructure is antiquated. It was designed to be, we were net importers, not exporters. And we really are playing a severe game of catch up. And I think a lot of times the exploring, the infrastructure and the refining play is actually better right now than the underlying crude play, because even though we have all this shale, it's not really adding to supply. We just can't get it to market.
So let's talk. The problem is that it's bottlenecked, and that is some of the problem here. Mm-hmm. But let me kind of switch gears for a second, because I want to look at, we talk about futures, talk about a little bit about currency, talk about the ideas that you have. We have these narratives. On one hand, a technical trader, pure straight up unabashed technical trader, as you mentioned at the top, you look at a chart. Many people look at the symbol and make a, have a predetermined story, a kind of a precondition to what's going on, right? Whereas a technical, truly straight up purist will say, I don't even care what that symbol is. Matter of fact, blank it out, blank it all out. And what they do is they go on a chart and they can try to figure out directional bias and utilizing either whether it's indicators or whether it's, just trend lines or whatever it is that they're using. So my question to you is, how do you initially find trades that you like? Is it through a fundamental process, narrative, news story, technical? What is it that you do to focus in on a trade, something that you're going to actually work on?
For me, and maybe it's because I like the story. I think story and psychology is ultimately what does move price. I like to find a story that is coinciding with price action. So for me, my process is usually going to be finding a story that I can wrap my brain around, where the price action is nicely dovetailing with it. But I think it's less important where we start. Some traders are going to be more comfortable finding a technical reason. Some traders are going to like the price action or some sort of price pattern. But I think to be a well-rounded trader in the 2000s, and I don't think this would have been the case when I was trading in the 80s or the 90s, you really have to understand all facets of the game, technicals, price, and fundamentals. And when those all line up to tell you the same story, technically bullish, price bullish, fundamentally bullish, you've got then a trade. So I think it's less important that the trader absolutely follow a methodology from, say, fundamentals, price, technicals, whatever that, and that they actually hit all three, almost like a checks and balances.
Right.
Right? Where the technicals, the fundamentals, and the price action overlap, if you were to imagine like a Venn diagram, where they overlap, that's the sweet spot and that's the trade.
Interesting. All right. So the last thing I want to kind of go through here is, I think, have you been involved in the cryptocurrency markets?
I sure have.
And So these days, things aren't looking as good for the HODLers. Things have gotten a little, kind of off the rail a little bit there. But with regard to Bitcoin and Bitcoin futures, I knew a lot of people back when Bitcoin futures was first starting to come out, and the thought of it was like, oh, that's the end, over. And sure enough, it wasn't. It was the initially rose really nicely, right? And then all of a sudden things came in. So what's your thought on the Bitcoin futures and the whole Bitcoin and cryptocurrency markets in terms of a place that will be viable moving forward?
So I think, again, when you talk about story and narrative, you know, always trying to find out what narrative's going to get, in this case, a bullish argument kickstarted. And that's really probably what the cryptocurrency market, which is still, you know, kind of, if you want to blanketly call it the Bitcoin market, obviously we have Ethereum, we have Litecoin, we have Ripple, all sorts of NeoCoin, but Bitcoin is still the way in which we gauge all of crypto. What's really interesting is you look at the one coin cryptocurrency contract that trades on the CBOE, which is the XBT contract. The contract low, the low that we put in back in February, was actually down at about, I believe it's 6,000 or 5,900, that area. And we're levitating just above that area right now. So we are just testing lows from February, even though it's continued to fall. If the trader out there is, like you said, a hodler, right? Holding on for dear life. If they are a hodler, this is probably one of the first times that it makes sense to say, look, if I'm a believer in the narrative of blockchain and what tokens and cryptocurrency can mean in the future, this area between about 6,100 and 5,900 is about as tactical a spot someone can build a position. Mm-hmm. Not 19,000, not 10,000. You know, you get right against that floor that was proven back in February, makes sense. I don't think the story is going anywhere. I don't know, you know, where the low is. The narrative is in the blockchain. We're so early in this story. I think what's happened now is we've shaken loose a lot of those traders that were interested, 17, 16,000, 15,000. And now that frenzy is gone, we're really going to get a good, real story. And the people that step in now, I'd say 6,100, I think are going to be the ones that have the tolerance to look at this and say, at least 1 to 3, if not 3 to 5 year time horizon. They're willing to see where this narrative goes, not that momentum speculation that we saw when we were flirting with 20,000. So I believe in it as much as ever, because the people still around, they get it. They've got the patience, and it's a real commodity to them.
I mean, I hope the one thing I could, if I saw a major shakeout, I'm not talking about, you know, down to 5,800. I'm talking about, you know, you shake it down to 3,500 and close down a lot of the ancillary coins that were just started, the old coins that were just started as, with white papers and these junk names out there. Get rid of a lot of mm-hmm. those. And what would happen is then, you know, people mm-hmm. refocus on the core names. So kind of like the super small caps, right? Get rid of that crap. And then maybe there mm-hmm. would be an opportunity there. But, you know, if you don't do that, I do fear that you're going to see, and maybe it would be a good thing, you know, the same kinds of things going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And, you know, people, you know, buying, Bitcoin just to transfer to another account, just to buy the other coin in that name, or Ethereum so they could buy the coin in the, you know, in the cross trade there. But I don't know. I'm a little skeptical still.
You bring up a great point. You know, can we separate the blue chips, if you will, from the penny stocks of this particular universe in terms of crypto? I completely agree. One thing, though, from a narrative, and I like the timing of it, is that Coinbase has now become regulated. And that's the biggest exchange in the U.S. Most people, that's their wallet. It's the Coinbase wallet. And you're seeing companies like Coinbase get more regulated, and they're willing to start to work with the different exchanges and the different regulative bodies in order to become a legitimate exchange. And I think that's going to start to pique some curiosity about, you know, now are they regulated? Now, you know, they're really under the purview that any equity would be. And I think it's going to increase some confidence in this market. And that just happened, a week or two ago. Yep. And we happen to be now sitting at a technical level where people like myself are saying, I like this price here. I like 6,100, I like 6,000. So I think those two converging is very interesting right now.
Well, the regulation will be very handy, but, you know, we still have to, the last couple of real whacks on this whole universe was really the hacking that goes on, and the concern that, hey, wait a minute, could somebody just take my stuff? You know, different than a stock. I mean, you know, how do you, you can't really just, I mean, you could send stocks around, but it's a much different process. But, you know, if we can get beyond and shake off this worry about the hacking and making it a little bit more secure somehow, that maybe will be the way to go. And maybe the regulation and the process there will make it happen, because that would be something that would, I think, would bring back a lot of confidence in the markets that has been lost recently.
I agree. And I think that's just a process that will be, this is such a young market. I think that's a process that's slowly going to have to earn back trust. But it's interesting, when a market is flying and we were, you know, flying north of 10, 12, 13, 14,000, nobody cared about safety then. So it's amazing how greed makes us turn a blind eye to things that really were just as relevant then as they are now. But you're right, people are going to be much more looking at this market with a whole lot more scrutiny. You're absolutely right.
That is a story that will repeat itself every, I would say, 10 years or so. That mm-hmm. story you just mentioned about people being somewhat, you know, immune and just simply disregard any risk because of, in the name of making money, is a theme we see every 10 years, and it always ends in tears for some people. Not for everybody, but for some people, right?
So, you're absolutely right. Greed is blind. Yeah, exactly. They say love is blind. I think greed is pretty darn blind too.
Yeah, deaf and blind. Raji Horner, the queen of queens, the queen of trading from Simpler Trading. I appreciate you spending some time with us today.
Thank you very much. I enjoy this, and great points. I mean, you're going to have me thinking back on some of the narratives that I've been building some trades on. So I thank you for the time. Thank you.
All right, thanks. All right, talk to you. Bye-bye. Good stuff. Good stuff. Really appreciate the information from our guests and getting back to our discussions about markets and finance. So hopefully you learned a little bit there. We have some questions I had mentioned, and we'll do it in no particular order. About two or three of them that came in that I thought would be interesting for the show. First one's from Jerry V. And like I said, if you do want to ask a question, just go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, click on the Ask Andrew button, and just ask away. Jerry writes, he says, when companies buy back shares, I don't always hear when and what they intend to do with those shares. Is it that important? It seems to me that there's a big difference to the share value if the shares are retired versus held to be reissued or distributed to the employees. Where is this information published on what a company decides to do with their shares bought back? That's a good question. It's actually, if you think about that, that would be of interest, because if they decide to just keep it as treasury shares, it's one thing. If they're possibly going to reissue them and just put them out there at a later date, that's another. If they maybe are going to use that as a currency to buy another company, problem is they don't know what they're doing with it. The purpose of buying back shares is, in a sense, financial engineering, where they're able to increase the value of the company, because if you do a multiple factor based on earnings and you use earnings per share, there are less shares that are out there that are now being used to calculate that. Therefore, what happens is that there's a natural increase in the value. Then also, of course, you have the fact that they're just simply buying shares. Therefore, there's someone in the market that's buying shares back. They don't tell you what they're doing with it because they don't know. They don't know what, they would like to think that it's going to hold on to it, that this is the, quote, best option for the money that's available to them, that they really think that this is a great investment in their own company and therefore they're just going to stick to that. However, again, they don't necessarily know that. They're not going to tell you if they're going to reissue it, because that would be an offering, a secondary offering, and therefore that would just defeat the whole purpose of what they're doing. Giving it to employees? I don't think so. That, you know, they do that through options grants usually. So there is no way that I am aware of that you could find out what they're thinking of doing, because I honestly don't think that they know what they're doing at the given time. In the future, they would, of course. Next question comes in from Chris. But by the way, that was a great question. I think it was a great question. Next question comes in from Chris B. He says, I apologize if this has been asked and answered before, or if it's raised too far from your area of expertise. Given that it appears to be an unprecedented volatility in the markets, we are automated micro traders, that is, those that are performing automated programmatic trades based on small but steep price changes, printing money as a result of this phenomenon? Or Are they paralyzed because the volatility does not conform to their algorithms? Perhaps volume plotted against volatility might answer this. I mean, Chris, I think there's there's two schools of thought on this, and I think you have some of this right on. You have the momentum traders that are trading in the direction of, let's say, 30-second, 1-minute tick, 5-minute, 30-minute, whatever particular bar and style they're using. You know, if the swing traders, inside day traders, or the scalp traders, I don't know. You know, it could be any of those. And as such, once things get brewing in one direction, you see them kind of moving dramatically in that direction. There's something else you've seen lately. When things move down very significantly, well, you see the attempt to blow out the shorts on the way back up. If you see things move up dramatically, you see the shorts kind of pile in and see if they can move things lower and battle out. It's like a battle of the bots. There is a lot of automation going on in here. And yes, there is some moves that happen. I don't think that we're talking about unprecedented volatility. I've seen a lot more volatility in my day. It's almost normalized volatility of late, although it happens a lot quicker. The reaction to data and news and items that show up occurs much more on the actual item than allowing it to sink in and then making a decision. Headline reading automation, bots, if you will, are really doing a lot to add to some of the volatility and the moves in the market. But I don't think that there's significantly that much more bigger volatility. Still, the VIX right now at 15, and where to get to a high of, I don't know, you know, 35 for a moment, split second moment. And that was a real aberration, by the way. So I think that right now that you know, when we see the VIX at about 15, that's a normal volatility rating expectation for the next however long out and outward looking, whether you're looking at the short term or long term VIX options. And the VIX value, if you will, I don't think that it's anything more than just the progression of automation and computers and the algorithms that are able to take advantage of this and possibly get out quicker, move in quicker, and either take profits or move out, and so they don't have losses at a much faster pace. And I think it really has to do with more of the computers than anything else. I just don't see it as a lot more volatility. It may seem like that if you're staring at the screen, but step back a couple of feet and look. It doesn't look that big. Next question is from Bob S. He says, Andrew, with Europe and China willing to buy Iran's oil in their currencies, what effect will it have on the U.S. dollar and our reserve currency? China has always been, has always wanted their currency to be the new reserve currency. Kind of looks like our isolationist policy may affect our status at the world and enhance China's. What do you think? I think there is something to be said about that. And I talked about that with Raji for a moment about China buying, having the ability to buy oil now with the futures and their currency. I think that they are pressing to have themselves as the reserve currency. I just don't know if that's actually going to happen. I think there's a lot of concern in the rest of the world about their ability to manipulate and to really throttle and draw back their currency at whim. They're setting the rates on that more so than the markets. So I just don't know if that's going to be a play. You know, we've heard that maybe these cryptocurrencies would supersede all of this, that there's going to be no need to have a country have a currency for everybody, because the universal currency one day is going to be, you know, X coin, whatever it's going to be, whatever particular name of coin that you'd like to pick, whether it's one of the big names that we know now, like a Bitcoin or an Ethereum or a Litecoin or Bitcoin Cash or Ripple or Neo, whatever. Or if it's going to be something different entirely, or if the U.S. is going to stay. I would think that if you look at the structure and status of the U.S., it would seem to me that it would probably be very hard-pressed for the rest of the world to vote on, if you will, China as the reserve currency. I just don't see it happening. Does the isolationist and protectionism type of policy hurt us? I think it does. I think it hurts us in the long haul from this whole idea of having a world's, quote unquote, world's reserve currency, because we're closing the doors. We're literally talking about building a wall, literally. and the tariffs are going into play, and therefore, you know, we have to worry about the currencies and how that affects other countries, and we look at how the dollar is moving up, and our currency is now affecting, like, the emerging markets, and, you know, it's affecting other things around the world, and if we could put tariffs on, we may have a problem with all this. So I see where you're going here. I just don't know the probability and how high it is. But I get what you're saying. All right, that's going to end that little segment on listener questions. I want to thank you for joining me as always. We have some great guests coming up. We have, of course, in the middle of this week, smack in the middle on Wednesday, hump day is July 4th. So I'm not sure how much volume and how much play we're going to see in the markets this week due to the fact that probably the summer is starting for a lot of people. And Thursday and Friday, who knows who's working? We'll have to see about that. I will be. I'm sure you're going to be too. Markets will be open. Not on the 4th, of course. But anyway, if you have questions, visit over thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Stay tuned for lots of discussion on DH Unplugged on Tuesday evening at 9 p.m. Make sure to come over and find out what we have to offer over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com too. We'll get some exciting announcement coming up for Investology soon. Some cool stuff happening there. Otherwise, I wish you a great week. I'll speak to you next time. Have a good one.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.